Welcome to the Authentically American Podcast, featuring inspiring stories from great Americans who are making a difference. Your host is West Point grad, former Army Ranger, and founder of Authentically American, Dean Wegner.
Welcome to the Authentically American Podcast, featuring inspiring stories of great Americans who are making a difference. I'm your host, Dean Wegner, and I'm here today with my good friend and special guest, Mr. Daryl Waltrip. Daryl Waltrip is a man who needs no introduction. He's an American.
Time out. That's the worst introduction in the world. A man that needs no introduction. So, but go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Continue.
No, I go ahead. No, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Let me cut that part out then.
You said we were going to be loose and have fun. So, so go ahead.
Here we go. I won't bother saying anything about Daryl. Then he's a bum. He's a bum.
Now we're going somewhere.
But somewhere along that journey, he was inducted into NASCAR Hall of Fame. He won a few races.
A few.
Forget how many, but
84. I mean, these are things that are important.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Somehow,
this should be in the introduction. 84 wins, you know, those kind of things.
Yada yada yada, and somehow, those guys on Fox Sports, thought it fitting to bring you on board.
Yeah.
So, all that aside, Daryl, what I'm most impressed and proud of you, in the midst of all this fame and fortune, is how you've lived true to your values and looked to
fame. Fame. Not so many fortunes, fame.
Got it. Cool. So, as I shared before, this is all about sharing stories. This is about hearing more. So, I want people to get to know you on a personal level. So, take us to the very beginning.
Oh, my.
Way back when you got started racing.
Yeah.
How did you get behind the wheel?
Well, I grew up in Owensboro, Kentucky, and there were four of us kids at the time. My dad drove a Pepsi-Cola truck, of all things, and my mom worked at the IGA. And so my mom and dad believed in, if you want something, you got to work for it, hard work. And that's what got my dad where he was. That's what mom believed, and that's what they instilled in us kids. When I would go with my dad in the summertime, particularly, and on the weekends when he was working on the Pepsi-Cola truck, we go by this hardware store called West End Hardware, and they sold go-karts. And I guess I was 11 or 12 years old at the time, and we'd walk in the store to service the store with the Pepsis, and they're hanging. There would sit this go-kart. And while my dad was busy bringing in the Pepsi-Colas, I was busy sitting on the go-kart just kind of dreaming and thinking in my mind, if I had one of these, I think I could drive it. I think I'd be really good if I had one of these. But they were like, now you got to remember this in the 60s. I think that thing was $300. That was a lot of money in the 60s. We didn't have $300 spare dollars. We were week to week. My dad was famous for, it doesn't matter how much it costs, son, how much a month is it? That's what we worry about. And so, okay, Dad. So in the end, I kind of conned my dad into buying the go-kart. We figured out how much a month it was. And I'd committed to mowing yards. That's what we did back in the day. I would mow yards, and I would make enough money to make the payment on the go-kart if Dad would buy the go-kart for me. So he did. And that started my racing career. I'd gone to races with my grandmother when I was a little kid at 6, 7 years old, and sat in the grandstands and watched my hero at the time, G.C. Spencer. So as a kid, I grew up around racing. My dad was not a racer, but he was what we called a shade tree mechanic. And by the way, if you don't know what that is, my dad on a weekend would pull a car, our family car, he would pull it up under a tree and take the motor out of it. He would pull the motor out of the car with a chain hoist, maybe flip it over, check the bearings, you know, all the rod bearings.
Routine.
Sure everything was good in the engine. Put a split manifold so it had, you know, loud tailpipes. So a shade tree mechanic is a guy that just finds a tree, puts up a chain hoist, and pulls the engine out of the car. And that's where they got their nickname, shade tree mechanic. So my uncles and a lot of people in our family were mechanically inclined, but nobody had ever raced. But I just had a feeling. I think it's a God-given thing. I just think I always had a feeling if I ever get behind the wheel of a race car, in this case, a go-kart to start with, if I ever get behind the wheel of one of these things, I believe I'd be really good. I believe I could do it. I believe if I get the opportunity, I could be a great driver. And that was a kid growing up in Owensboro, in a little town, 52,000 people. A lot of race fans in Owensboro, a couple of little racetracks there. So there was racing in the community. But I just felt like something in told me, the Lord told me, that this is what you were meant to do. And so I started racing go-karts, and I was really good, and I won like 500 go-kart races. Had little trophies, some be this big, some be this big, but little trophies from everywhere I went, a lot of go-kart races. And then when I got to be 16, I got my driver's license. My dad and I built what we called then a hobby car. Mm-hmm. Hobby car is a little jalopy, you know, a 36, 30, 34, 30. Two Ford coupe with a six-cylinder motor, and it ran them on dirt. And a quick story, it might be too late for that, but anyway, we went to the first, we built this car, worked on it all winter long. The track opens, and they have an open practice. And so, and we what we call flat-towed the cars, didn't have a trailer or a truck, and they had a tow bar. So you put the race car behind your car, and you towed it to the track. So my dad and I, it was so excited. And my dad and I get this little car, and we get it all finished. It's number six, because it was a six-cylinder motor, made sense, six-cylinder. And on the side, you had to have a sponsor. We didn't have any sponsors, so we put Wild Child. So my first car was number six with Wild Child on the side of it. We go to the track, and I'd never been in a car now. I just barely had my driver's license. I'd never raced on dirt, so I knew zero about what I was doing. And it didn't take long for that to become obvious. I got in the car, and we got there early. On a dirt track, they what they call water the track down. And then when the cars get there, they kind of run the track in and get a groove kind of developed. But it takes time. But I don't know all this stuff. I just want to get in this car, and I want to make some laps. So we're at Ellis Speedway. I get in the car, and I get in that, and I go, and then I go out on the track, and the track's muddy. It's real muddy. And I go down the first turn, and I'm kind of all over the place, and I think, I must not be going fast enough. So I'm going to have to gas her up a little bit. So I pick up a little speed, going down the back straight, and I get to the third turn, and I turn in like you do on a regular car. See, I'd never seen the Cars movie. You got to turn right to go left. If I'd have seen that first, this would have never happened. But I turned the car in like I'd done my go-kart all this time. Turn the car in, the car don't turn. It just goes straight. Guess where it goes straight? Straight right into the wall.
Ouch.
Never made a lap. Never made it all the way around the track.
Not even one.
And these cars back in the day, they had what they called straight axle. So when I hit the wall, I just took the right front tire and just boom, flipped it up over the motor. We were done. I never made a lap. We didn't get to race that weekend. My dad was so upset. I think if there was such a term as knucklehead, he would have probably used that at the time. But anyway, so we get the car and we tow it back home. And our neighbor behind us, he was a pretty good mechanic, dad, me and all, everybody. So we get the car all straightened out and take it back to the track the next week. I learned my lesson that time. I knew better. I asked some questions. How do you make a car go left on a dirt track when it's muddy like that? And they said, well, you got to sling it in the corner. You got to throw it in there. You got to turn it to the right, and then it'll go left. So I'm a quick learner, especially when it's costing me money. And that's what I did. So after I kind of figured that out, I wasn't very good on dirt to start with, but as time went by, I got to where I was pretty good, and started winning races on dirt. Another little track up in Owensboro called Whitesville was a paved racetrack, and they opened up. The guys that had been running at Ellis was dirt, and so Whitesville opens up as a paved asphalt racetrack. That was in my wheelhouse. That's who I was.
It's paved.
So they didn't know how to run. I didn't know how to run dirt, and they didn't know how to run asphalt. Mm-hmm. So when we come to Whitesville, I was the man. So I won a lot of races in Whitesville, and that was in Owensboro. And then in 69, I got married. Stevie and I been married almost 50 years, and met a man named P.B. Crow, who lived in Franklin, Tennessee. People always say, how'd you end up in Franklin? P.B. Crow offered me a ride in one of his cars. He had great cars. He raced at the fairgrounds in Nashville and won a lot of races. He got hurt, couldn't drive. he knew me from Owensboro. He'd come up there and race with us a little bit. He said, why don't you come down and drive my car on the weekends? I did that for a while, and then finally I said, Steve, she's in school in Kentucky Wesleyan College. Her dad was insisted that she go to school. I went to school for a little while there, but school wasn't for me. And so we moved to Franklin. She went to Vanderbilt, and I went racing. And that was the beginning of my career.
Something you said stuck with me there, because I think a lot of people have the perception that racing, you got to have a lot of money because cars are expensive.
Yeah.
But you said that first go-kart was on a payment plan.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
so is that, you grew up with money?
No. I'm not bragging about this, but these are just facts. My dad had a fourth grade education, and he quit school to work to provide, to help, you know, help the family. And my mom, I'm not sure how far she went to school, maybe sixth grade. So they both just knew you had to work. You had to have a job. You had to work hard. And that's what they taught us. And what the other thing, my dad had a great personality. His name was Leroy. And everywhere that Leroy went, people loved him because he was funny, engaging, kind, considerate, understanding. I mean, he was a cool guy to know. Yeah. And he was so successful in Owensboro in the Pepsi-Cola business that's actually how he retired from Pepsi-Cola in 85 or 86, I think it was, with a great retirement plan and everything else, because his work ethic and who he was, and people in Owensboro, small town, they love my dad. And so when Pepsi-Cola built a big warehouse in Owensboro, they told dad they wanted him to run it, and he run it till the day he retired. So I learned a lot from my dad. I learned you had to be nice to people. If you're nice to people, not normally they're nice to you. And I couldn't do racing on my own. We had the money. By this time there were five of us kids.
Wow.
My sister Carolyn, my brother Bobby, my sister Connie, and then Michael, my younger brother. By the way, my brother, not my son. A lot of times Michael gets really upset. I don't really care, but Michael would check in a hotel or go somewhere and say, hey, man, your dad was in here a little while ago. And Michael said,
didn't like that.
I'm not sure about that. But anyway, so there were five of us kids living in a small house. And I knew that, you know, I couldn't make it in racing. It cost too much, expensive. But I had a natural talent. People, when I drove, they saw that and they wanted to help me. And that's how I got to where I was. Where I've been, I mean, I couldn't have done it on my own. I didn't have the resources. All I had was a lot of talent, a lot of desire, a big dream, but no money.
Yeah. So when did you get that first big break into NASCAR?
I always think that when I moved down here, that was a big deal for Stevie and I. Her mom and dad my mom and dad believed that I maybe could make it as a driver. Stevie's mom and dad, on the other hand, they weren't so sure. And so we got married, hadn't been married long, and I wanted to move from Owensboro to Franklin. Stevie's mom and dad, they weren't real happy about that. And so that was a big move for us, to move that far south. You got to remember, back in the day, it took about 3 hours to drive from Owensboro to Nashville. It was a long way down here. And so you didn't want to make that trip every day. But I moved down here, and PB loved racing. He had driven. He was a driver. He had a company called Crowell & Reed Trucking Company. It's down on just on the entrance of Franklin there, Bridge Street, I think it is. And that's where his trucks were. That's where his shop was. That's where he kept his race cars. He got great race cars. He bought cars from Bobby Allison. Bobby built him cars. He and Bobby were great friends. And PB got hurt, and he wanted me to drive his cars at the fairgrounds, which was a huge step up for me. I did, and every time I drove the car, I won. And, of course, PB was a funny man. He would tell me, I'd say, man, they're having a big race over in Maryville, Tennessee. I'd sure like to go to it. We'll go. He said, you can go anywhere you want to. Only one thing. You better bring back the trophy. That's how he felt. He spent a lot of money, had nice cars, good engines, gave me what I needed.
I believed in you.
Only thing he told me is, if you go, you can go anywhere you want to. Just bring back a trophy. Now, a few times I had to stop at a store to buy a trophy to bring back home. But that's beside the point.
That's right.
No, he was that was a big break for me. And because of my dominance at the fairgrounds in Nashville at the time, you got to remember this in the 70s. So fairgrounds was a big deal in the 70s. One of the best premier short tracks in the country. They had two cup races there, two NASCAR cup races there every year. And that's where I got my first win, was in Nashville in 1975. And I told this story a couple of weeks ago, and it just had dawned on me. I'd forgotten about it. But I'll never forget, my dad was, he believed in me, but he was not so sure that I was ever going to make it as a race car driver, because that's a big step.
Oh yeah.
And so he would not always be the most positive person in the world. I don't know why you want to keep doing this. You're just wasting your time. I don't know why you want to keep doing this. You know, you don't have any money. I don't know why a kid from Owensboro thinks he's ever going to amount to anything. You just need to run these little short tracks around here and be happy. That was kind of the way my dad approached everything. So I'll never forget, in 1975, it's May, it's Mother's Day weekend, I won my first cup race.
Wow.
That's a big deal. I always felt like if I was going to win a race, it'd probably be at the fairgrounds, because that was my track. That was my stomping grounds. That was my wheelhouse. So I won my first cup race in Nashville, 1975. Celebrating, everybody's happy. It's about the greatest day of my life.
Oh, yeah.
And it gets better. My dad comes up to me after the race, puts his arm around me. My dad never told me he loved me. I don't know if he ever told me he loved me until he got older. But I don't think my dad ever told me he loved me. He put his arm around me and said, "Son, I got to admit I was wrong." Mm. He said, "You're a better man than me."
Wow.
"I would have given up a long time ago. Congratulations. You did it." That was huge.
I can't even imagine.
For my dad and for me. And so we went, my dad and mom went to all the races with us. And then eventually Stevie's mom and dad, they went to a lot of races with us. And everybody became a fan. And everybody felt like, given the opportunity, that I could be successful.
Yeah.
And so we all, Stevie's mom and dad, everybody did all they could to help me get to where I needed to go. So I couldn't. Family, I don't care what you're doing. You know, if you don't have your family behind you and you don't have the support of your family, you might be able to do it, but it's going to be pretty difficult. The love and the care and the support you get from your family is what keeps you going in those really dark, bad, lonely times when you wreck on the first lap.
That story with your dad really resonates with me, because I think my dad was in the same mold.
Yeah.
You know, man of very few words, but yeah, when he used them, they were powerful.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, graduating from West Point,
yeah,
I don't remember him saying too much, but, you know, just the smile and look and pride, and,
yeah,
you know, my son did it.
Yeah.
And he wasn't sure,
yeah,
if I was going to make it.
Yeah. Well, see, my dad thought you could get a whole lot more out of a mule kicking it in the ass than you could patting it on the back. And so that was his theory. And when I won that race, that was my car. My team, my guys, we all built that car over in Charlotte, over in Harrisburg, where my shop was. Built that car. Ray Fox Jr. built that engine. My pit crew. It was my deal. It wasn't like I drove for somebody else. I think when Dad saw that all come together and how excited everybody was, I think he bought into it, and he was into it till the day he died. Great story.
What a great story. And I think he may not have expressed the words, but just hearing early on that he was committing financially when there was not a lot there.
Oh, yeah.
The
well, he was all, Dad was okay with it. Mom, on the other hand, not so much. I'll never forget, we lived in 648 Greenbrier Street, 684-1073. That's the phone number. Probably not there anymore. But anyway, it's funny how you remember things. Mm-hmm. But I'll never forget, we were working on the go-kart one time, and we had the engine apart. And go-kart engines aren't very big, and lawnmower engines. So we needed a place to work on the engine, because the garage wasn't heated. It was kind of cold in the wintertime. So we took the go-kart engine into the kitchen and put some newspaper down on the kitchen table and disassembled the engine in the kitchen. Mom wasn't there, by the way. And so we got this engine all torn apart on the kitchen table, mm-hmm, and we needed a place to wash some parts. So we're washing parts in Mom's kitchen sink.
Uh-oh.
And she came home from work.
Uh-oh.
And she was not happy with
her kitchen.
Dad and I. And the funny thing was, I'll never forget, we had a, I forget what we dropped, but we dropped something on the floor and it put a big divot, like a chip out of the terrazzo on the floor or on the water tile or whatever it was. And that mom, Dad was going to fix that. Mom said, "No, I want y'all to leave that there." Mm-hmm. So every time you think about bringing an engine into my kitchen, that little divot will remind you, don't do that.
Turn around and go back the other way.
Go back to the garage.
We've mentioned Stevie,
yeah,
a few times, and you know, we've enjoyed getting to know each other, DW, and a lot of things we have in common. One of them sounds like each of us married up.
Oh yeah,
my wife Kelly. So tell us the story how you and Stevie met.
Well, it's the darndest thing. We lived on opposite sides of town. I lived on Mortgage Lane, and she lived in Stone Creek Park. Uh-huh. And so her dad was president of Texas Gas. My dad drove a Pepsi truck. So we had nothing in common. Mm-hmm. She was a beautiful redhead. I knew her sister, Carol, but I didn't know Stevie that well because she's much younger than me. She's 3 years younger than I am. So, you know, I'm an older guy and she's a younger girl. But anyway, we went to the same high school together. But we went to the same high school. We just didn't go out at the same time. And so our paths would cross every now and then. I'd see her out at, you know, one of my PD Spotlight Inn, place where I like to eat lunch, her and her mom or her and her sister. And she had gone away to boarding school, the Holton Arms in Washington. And so she'd been out of town for a while. And I was working at Don Moore Chevrolet, and I was their high-performance expert. Mm-hmm. And that meant I got to drive a lot of really fast cars. And so I was in there one day playing shuffleboard and with my buddies. It was on a Friday. And I'd just gotten paid, and so I had a good week. I made some money. And Stevie and her mom came in. They sat on one side, and his shuffleboard's on the other side. And me and my rowdy friends are over there playing shuffleboard. And I walk around and ask Petey to get me a beer or Pepsi or what, I don't remember. And I saw Stevie and her mom. And her mom was a beautiful lady from Boston. And her and Stevie were having lunch. And we made eye contact. And so I went over and I said, you're Carol's sister Stevie, right? She said, I said, haven't seen you around much. Well, I've been away at school and I'm back home now. Oh, wow, cool. So I went back, played a little show. I come back and they were getting ready to leave. I said, hey, like go to a movie sometime? Just casually, you know? Huh? Yeah, call me. Gave me her phone number. And so I eventually called her and eventually we went out and eventually we got married. So, but not... Her mom and dad were not excited, to say the least, about her marrying a race car driver. And that's what I told, I'll never forget. So I asked Stevie, would she marry me? She said, I will, under one circumstance. You've got to ask my dad.
Right.
And Mr. Rader was a big man. He's from Texas. He's about 6'5", kinky hair, kind of smoked a cigarette, and... I wouldn't say the most friendliest man I ever met at the time.
It's intimidating, it sounds like.
Yeah, so I said, all right, I'll do it. I'll ask your dad. Well, I didn't know Mr. Rader had a tremor. I don't know if you know what tremors are or not, but it makes your head bob.
Okay.
And so I don't know this. Mm-hmm. So I go out to their house on a Friday night before we go out on a date, and I asked Mr. Rader, could I talk to him? And he said, oh, you want to talk to me? Had a cigarette, and I said, yes, sir, if you don't mind, I'll talk to you for a minute. Come into the den. So we go in the den. He sits down in his big leather chair, and I'm sitting on the couch, and he's puffing on a cigarette. And I said, been going with Stevie for a while and gotten kind of serious, and I'd like to ask your blessings to marry her. And he looked at me, and his head started. That tremor kick, when you get nervous or upset, that tremor would kick in. Uh-oh. And he started shaking his head no. I mean, that's the way it goes. And I thought, damn. Uh-oh. I mean, he hadn't even responded yet, and he's already shaking his head no. Anyway, he says, young man, let me tell you, if that's what my daughter wants, then that's what my daughter, then I'm not going to stop you, but I'm not going to bless it.
Wow.
I said, well, we've talked about it, and I said, I think that's what we're going to do. And he said, fine, if she's old enough, she's 18 years old, she can do what she wants to. He said, but just, no, I'm not going to give you my blessing. But we went on. We got married. And it turned out great because you got to remember something about racing back in the day. I mean, you know, most people, when they thought about racing, particularly someone that had a lifestyle like Mr. Rader did, he was the president of a big corporation, spent a lot of time in Washington, D.C. Stevie's mom went to Tufts. She was born in Boston. So they have a different lifestyle than I have. I lived on the poor side of town, and like I said, she lived in Stone Creek Park. So two totally different lifestyles. But we loved each other and we cared about each other and we wanted to get married. And so we did. And it was a little rough to start with. Christmas dinners, Thanksgiving dinners, they weren't always the most enjoyable time of my life. I went to a cocktail party, which they had a lot of them. I'll never forget, and it was so embarrassing. So I'm there, and it's right after we got married. I'm at a cocktail party, and we're at the Raiders house. A lot of these important people from Owensboro, with all, you know, at the dinner party. And they go by with a bowl of pistachios. Uh-huh. Oh, I love nuts, you know. Oh, yeah. Would you like some nuts, sir? Oh, yes, I'll take some. They got me a handful and shook them in my hand. Popped those babies in my mouth. I said, something's not right here. I didn't know you had to open them up and take the little pistachio. So that was rather embarrassing. And I had other embarrassing moments like that. There are a lot of things that they ate that I'd never eaten. There's a lot of things they did that I'd never done. But if it hadn't been for my father-in-law and our relationship and the things I learned from him and the things that he taught me and the friendship that we had, it would have been very difficult.
Was there a turning point where
You
won him over?
There was. So it's always about, you know, my whole life evolves around racing. It always has. Mm-hmm. I went to a race in Salem, Indiana. And Salem, the High Bank half mile, similar to Nashville. And some friends, Mr. Raiders, were going to that race. It's a couple hours from Owensboro. And they asked Mr. Rader if he'd like to go, because he's a big race fan. He had worked in the pits in Indy. So he was one of the stewards in the pits at Indy, and he and Mr. Elmer, the chairman of Texas Gas, they were huge race fans. And they asked Mr. Rader, would he like to go to the race in Salem with them? He said, I don't really think so. Well, your son-in-law is going to be racing. Well, I might go. I might go. So sure enough, he goes. And sure enough, lo and behold, I win the race. Now, he's in the grandstand. Mm-hmm. Steve and I don't even know he's there. We hadn't talked to her mom, and we didn't know he'd come with his friends, and so he's in the grandstand. I win the race, and in Salem they don't have a victory circle. You just stop on the racetrack at the start finish line, and that's where they do the celebration. And so here I am standing on the front straightaway with my trophy and Stevie and all that's going on around us, and Mr. Raider's in the grandstand telling his buddies, "Hey, that's my son-in-law. that's my daughter," and. That turned things around because he saw me race, he saw me win, and he had an eye. He had a pretty good eye for talent, and so he knew I was pretty good at what I'd chosen a good profession for me. And from that point on, they became very, very helpful. Could have never accomplished anything that I've accomplished hadn't been for Stevie's dad, her mom, and that family.
So you'd mentioned winning in that race, DW, and these are some of the numbers that you alluded to.
See, these are this is what I was talking about, introduction. You know, you got to get to
Is this a typo or is it really 84,
yeah, 84
races you won?
Yeah.
And there were 390 or more top tens?
Yeah, a lot of top tens.
So is there one over all those years just stands out and say, you know what, this was the one that really...
Yeah, I don't really like to. You know, people ask me that all the time, and I think it's the sum of all the parts. Mm-hmm. When you get to this point in your life, getting in the Hall of Fame, I mean, that's a big deal. Oh, yeah. That's the icing on the cake. certainly that first win in 75 in Nashville mm-hmm. with my whole, my grandmother who took me to races when I was a kid, 6 years old, she was there with my grandfather. Michael, my little brother, he's about 12, 14 at the time. He's there. Mom and Dad, Stevie, my crew. I mean, it's a really cool picture. I look at it awesome. Quite often. But that picture of all of us in Victory Lane, that's pretty hard to say that's not your most memorable, most favorite win.
Oh, yeah.
But Daytona, the Daytona 500, tried for 17 years to win that race, and every year something happened, he'd get away. Earnhardt and I had this, you know, he never won it until, he won it once, I won it once. I won it in 89, he won it in 98. But it just seemed like it always eluded us. The one you wanted the most, the one it meant the most, it just get away from you.
Yeah.
Something would, the car would break, there'd be a wreck. Something would always happen. You'd have a car that was capable of winning, and something would always happen. But on the 17th, in car 17, in my 17th try, the purse was $1.7 million. My name has 17 letters in it. And I told Hammond, my crew chief, Jeff Hammond, that day when the race, before the race started, he said, "What do you think?" I said, "Well, all these 17s are lining up. I'm not a believer in numerology or stars or, you know, I know that God does, he does it all." But I told Hammond, I said, "Well, here's how I figure, buddy. We're either going to finish first, or we're going to finish 17th. I'm not sure which one yet." So, but it turned out that day we won that race, yeah. And that was a big deal. I won 7 races in a row at Bristol, Tennessee. And you asked any driver today, past, present, future, what's the toughest track that we go to? And every one of them, to a man, would probably say Bristol. 500 laps is probably the most grueling race that you can run. And I won 7 races in a row there. For 3.5 years, I'd only got one race there. And I won 12. I had the most wins at that track. So obviously that's one of my favorite tracks. Always, I had a motto. I always said, "Follow me in Tennessee." And so I had to make that stick. I had 12 wins at the fairgrounds in Nashville. I like short tracks. I like the small racetracks. That's what I grew up on. Mm-hmm. When I was moved to Nashville, the fairgrounds, Salem, Indianapolis Raceway Park, Huntsville, Alabama, Birmingham, Mobile. I raced 5 nights a week when I started. I'd race Thursday night in Huntsville. Same car, same everything. Maybe change the tires or something for whatever track. But I'd run Thursday in Huntsville, Friday in Birmingham, Saturday night in Nashville, and Sunday night in Owensboro.
Wow.
And if there was a special event somewhere on Sunday afternoon that I could get to, I'd run Sunday afternoon in time to make it down to Owensboro to run Sunday night. So, you know, I believed in the quantity, not so much in quality. But if I could make a little bit here and a little bit there, it all mounted up. It's like stacking pennies. But it was just fun at the time. It's just a lot of times it'd just be Stevie and I, and we had a little brown dog. His name was Charlie Brown, and the three of us would load up in a tow truck and we'd go racing. And I'd get to a track and then get somebody to help me. A lot of the races were 30 lappers, a few 100 lappers here and there, but most of the time it would show up, unload and race, load up and go to the next race, or load up and go home. So you didn't have to have a big crew.
Right.
You didn't have to have a lot of spare parts. You run the same car, same motor. Most times, same tires. Maybe have to change tires a little bit. But it was pretty easy to do by yourself. Mm-hmm. And we did that a lot, Stevie and I did. She was my pit crew.
Yeah. Let's shift gears real quick. Because when people heard, Daryl, that you'd invested in Authentically American and were a partner and a friend, what I heard continuously is, what a good guy.
Yeah.
DW is such a good guy.
I thought you were talking about you.
DW is, my wife would say.
Yeah, right.
Great guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
But was it always that way? You're always known as a good guy, or did you have some other?
Oh, no. I had my struggles. When I came into the big leagues, I'd been racing in these little racetracks, as I told you, around the Southeast, and I was the big fish. I mean, when I showed up, they said, "Oh, crap, you know, we're going to run second tonight." That was just, I was that kind of driver. I had that kind of car. So if I went to Huntsville, everybody said, "Well, who's going to run second tonight?" If I went to Salem, who's going to run second today? Because right. that's how dominant I kind of was at that time. And so I was a big fish in the pond. I go to NASCAR, I go to Cup, I go to the top of the the food chain, and all of a sudden nobody even knows I'm there or cares that I'm there. And some guys had heard of me, some guys hadn't. And so I wasn't happy about that. And I thought I was, you know, Richard Petty and David Pearson, Allison Baker, all those guys, I'm as good as they are.
Yeah,
I can outdrive them, but I didn't have the car at the time. Mm-hmm. And so one thing I noticed, and I always was PR oriented. I learned that in Nashville. Joe Carver, who was a PR director at the fairgrounds, Hope Hines and Joe and I, we do a little TV show every Saturday morning on Channel 5 called Pit Stop. And so I'd kind of been exposed to the media. I knew about TV, and there wasn't a lot of TV at the time. Most of it was just print media. But I knew how to kind of use, I don't know if you use a good word or not, but work with those people to get what I needed. And so I noticed when I first started in the Cup, if you said something derogatory about Richard Petty, that got in the paper. Rookie Darrell Waltrip said Richard Petty needs to get his prescription windshield changed. I thought it was funny. I thought it was hilarious.
I still think it's funny.
He didn't. He didn't think it was so funny because he was the king,
right?
And so I noticed in Cale Yarborough, I created the Cale scale, and so I was ribbing those guys all the time, and I was getting, by virtue of doing that, I was getting a lot of recognition, and everybody said I talked too much. I said no. I didn't talk too much. Those guys didn't talk at all.
Yeah.
I mean, if you went to ask them before or after the race, how'd your day go? Well, went good. So how'd your car run? Car run good. Crew? Oh, crew good, yeah.
Boring.
I mean, they just didn't have, they didn't elaborate.
Huh?
Me, on the other hand, you ask me one question, you stand back, because I got probably about a 30-minute answer for you.
Well, it sounds like Cale also thought of you as the big fish, because didn't he have an affectionate nickname for you?
Cale nicknamed me Jaws.
Dun, dun.
And Cale and I,
dun, dun,
yeah, I love that. Dun, 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 dun. Here he comes.
So why did he call you Jaws?
Yeah, well, it's funny. The movie was, that's right when the movie was, I think, late 70s. That's when the movie Jaws had come out. And, of course, when I saw Jaws the first time, I never went in the ocean for a long time. It scared the hell out of me. I mean, there's a thing like that in the water. I might not want to go in that. I might not want to go in the water. But anyway, so Cale Yarborough and I were we weren't necessarily rivals, but it turned out to be that way. But who was rivals was Herb Nabb, who was Cale's crew chief, and my crew chief, Jake Elder. They were rivals, and they were always trying to one-up each other. Herb thought he was the best crew chief. Jake thought he was the best crew chief. I got a better car. No, I got a better car. I'm smarter than you. No, I'm smarter than you.
Mm-hmm.
They played cards together. They spent a lot of time together talking about who was the greatest. I don't know how that worked out, but in the process, that would drag the two, the 11 car and the 88 car into the argument who had the best car. And so Cale drove for Junior Johnson, the great last American hero.
Yeah.
Cale had the best car. Cale was the best driver. I drove the Gatorade car, and I had a ragtag crew. I'd swapping people around all the time. But anyway, Cale and I ended up racing each other a lot at different tracks. And he had knocked my back bumper off one week. I'd knock his back bumper off the next. And he had roughed me up, and I'd rough him up. And so we became rivals. But we were at Darlington, Southern 500. And only one Southern 500. And back in the day, there was the crown jewels of racing. There was Daytona, the 500.
Mm-hmm.
There was Charlotte, the 600.
Yeah.
And there was the Southern 500. Those were the big three. So you wanted the really great drivers won all three of those in the same year, which didn't happen but just a couple of times. It's pretty hard to do. And so we're in the Southern 500, and I got the car to beat that day. And Cale and I end up in a battle right near the end of the race, and we're passing each other, passing, we're racing hard, and we come up on a lap car, and a lap car, slow car. So we come up on this lap car, and I can't figure out. Kale's right on my bumper. I'm saying, which way am I going to go? Which way am I going to go? So I'm going to go low. So I went low, and it was DK Alders. As I went low, he moved over to let to give the outside line.
Yeah.
You're supposed to move down. But I didn't have time to wait on him to decide what he's going to do. So I go to the inside. He moves down. Darlington is it's in South Carolina. Mm-hmm. Track's always sandy and dirty if you get out of the groove. So I get down in the sand and dirt again on my hot tires. And so when I come back up, try to get back up in the racing groove, get back up in front of Kale, I don't quite have – Kale's here, mm-hmm. and I don't quite have enough room to get in.
Yeah.
And I clipped him. Well, I clipped him and he clipped me and we both wrecked. And so we're out of the race. Both of us are out of the race. Both cars are wrecked. Mm-hmm. And so they asked Kale when the race is over, so what the hell happened out there anyway? He said, Jaws wrecked me. I said, what? Yeah, old Jaws. You know, he's always running his mouth, his mouth faster than he does his car. Just Jaws, always chewing up, eating up stuff. So he called me Jaws, and it stuck. Here's the funny thing. So that was Darlington. That was September. A couple of weeks down the road, we go to Charlotte for the fall race, and Humpy Wheeler, who's like the P.T. Barnum of promoters at the time, he decides he's going to do a little pre-race thing, which he was known for all of his pre-race activities. So he went down to Myrtle Beach and got a shark. A real shark. Now, it's alive. It was live.
Kind of stuffed.
So he gets the shark. He hooks it on the back of a wrecker, and he puts a chicken in his mouth because Kale was sponsored by Holly Farms. And he parades that shark with a chicken in its mouth around the track in the pre-race show. And that
got a little buzz.
Oh, that was unbelievable. Nobody had ever, they couldn't believe that somebody would have the gall to do that or the nerve to do that. And Jaws stuck. I mean, I was called Jaws for a long, long time, mm-hmm. mainly by Kale. But here's the thing about Kale. Coolest thing. So we're rivals, and we raced hard against each other. Kale won 3 championships in a row. And Kale came to me in 1980, and he put his arm around me. He said, DW, I'm going to tell you something. Mm-hmm. I haven't told anybody else. So you're the first person I've told. I'm leaving junior at the end of the year. I said, you're doing what? Yeah. That's the best car in racing. Why, are you crazy? I got a better deal, and I'm going to go somewhere else. He said, but I'm telling you this because Junior wants you to drive for him.
Oh,
I said, you got to be kidding. Junior Johnson wants me to drive for him? Mm-hmm. He said, that's what I'm telling you. And he said, if you're smart, you'll figure out a way to make that happen. Well, I was driving for a guy, Diegard, Bill Gardner, and he was tough. And I had a contract that I didn't know how I was going to get out of. I had 3 years on my contract to drive the Gatorade car. Now, all of a sudden, I got a chance to drive for Junior Johnson. So I go into it's the middle of the season, about May or somewhere along in there. So the next 6 months, I try to figure out how I'm going to get out of this contract. Well, long story short, I ended up having to pay Gardner $300,000, $100,000 for each year that was on my contract to get out of that contract so I could go drive the 11 car. But it was – I always thought it was
– for teammates.
It was an investment.
Yeah.
No, Kale left. Okay. He went to drive for MC Anderson.
Okay.
And MC was – Kale was kind of – Kale liked to make money, and MC offered him a lot more money. And always remember what Junior told me. We're negotiating our deal. We're in a little dark room in North Wilkesboro. Old attorney that's got a tiebreaker. That's how he typed. And old one of them old timey typewriters, you know, and that's how he'd do his. He'd make out. So Ed Sill and I are there, and we're trying to negotiate a deal to drive Junior's car. And so this old guy, he goes in the back room and hear him. Type out, changing the contract, come back out and give it to Junior. So he did. And, I'll never forget, we're at a table with Junior in a dark room, big old long table. Junior and this old attorney sitting on one side of the table. Me and Ed's a hot shot from Boston, you know, went to Harvard, and he's a smart guy. So he looks at Junior. Junior's got a little pair of half glasses, and he said, all right, Junior, I think we got a deal worked out here. I feel pretty good about this. I, th- think we can agree to this, but I got to ask you something. What are you going to do for DW if he wins the championship? Mm-hmm. And Junior looked over the top of his glass and he said, boy, I'm going to tell you what I'll do to him if he don't.
Turn the tables there.
That was Al Junior. That's the way he was. But, yeah, Cale went on to drive for MC Anderson, and I went on to drive for Junior. And it was the best move I ever made in my life. It was 6 years. Won three championships. The first year, 81, 82. Won 24 races. Two championships. 18 poles. The Bud Shootout. It's back to that, like I was in the beginning, where when we showed up, who's going to run second? Yeah. People had shirts that said anybody but Waltrip. It was just the greatest time of my life. It was fun. So I was there for 6 years, won three championships, and I think I won 40-some races driving that 11 Crown. It was a good time.
Let's shift gears to post-NASCAR. How did you decide broadcasting?
Well,
get into that world.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that was my decision. That wasn't necessarily what I wanted to do. I was 52, I think, somewhere in that range, and my career had kind of taken a turn. I'd been on top for a long time, and all of a sudden things kind of slowed down. I didn't win races, and it got harder and harder to be a successful driver. The team I was with in 99 and 2000 was not the greatest team I'd ever been on. I had, in my little mind, I'd always been able to carry a car. If you get me close, I can do the rest. Yeah. But it got too difficult to where I didn't have that kind of, I couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't do it by myself. I'd done it by myself for a long time. Give me a pretty good car and I'll get you a win. Give me a great car and I'll lap the field. But when I got into the latter years of my career, it just got harder and harder, and I couldn't do it by myself. I needed help, and I didn't have the kind of help I needed. So the last couple of years I drove were kind of miserable. Bill France Jr. came to me in 2000, and he said, I don't like to cuss, but Bill Jr. cussed, so I will. He said, boy, and he smoked. I said, yes, sir. He said, you've always been my go-to guy. I said, yes, sir. He said, but I'm going to tell you something. You don't want to hear it. I'm going to tell you. You need to get your ass out of that car. I said, man, what are you, here I am. I'm struggling. Right. I'm just trying to get by here with this team I'm on. And you come, you're the head of the sport, and you tell me I need to get out of the car. I said, well, I don't have any plans on doing that. And he said, well, I'm just telling you. He said, TV deal, we're getting ready to negotiate a new TV deal. You need to be a part of that. I said, all right, well, that was early in 2000. And then I met a guy named David Hill. And David Hill was the president of Fox Sports. And David Hill insisted that I retire from driving and do TV. And David was very convincing. Mm-hmm. And he brought me a contract. And I had an idea in my mind about what I wanted to make, which was a lot more than I probably should have made, but I had this idea in my mind, it's what I need to make. And he brought me a contract laid on the table just like that. He said, take a look at this and tell me what you think. Well, first thing I noticed was exactly what I wanted was what he had offered me.
Wow.
And so that turned out, he and I became great friends, and I signed a deal to go to work for Fox Sports in 2001. They gave me free rein. I hired every person. They would come to me, David Hill and Ed Gorin would come to me, and they'd say, what do you think about this? Nope, don't like that guy. What about this guy? Nope, don't like that guy. I like this guy, this guy, this guy, and this guy. All right, that's who we'll hire. Larry McReynolds was working. He was crew chief at the Childress's for Mike Skinner. And Larry and I had done a couple of races together, Saturday races, and good chemistry. Worked well together. Mike Joy, good chemistry, worked well together. That was who I wanted to work with. Mike Joy, me, and Larry McReynolds. And that's the team we put together. Pit Road Reporters. I wanted Steve Burns. Steve was one of my best friends. Matt Yoakum. I don't even remember who else. But there were just like, I had this all-star lineup, and they hired every one of them. And so that's how we started off in the TV deal. But it wasn't I wouldn't necessarily say it was what I wanted to do, but after I signed the deal and realized that it's going to be a lot of fun and better than I thought, probably a lot. I'm a team guy. I like being on a team, and this is a dream team, and this could turn out to be something really good, and it did. It turned out to be awesome. And the first race was 2001, Daytona 500. And, of course, if you're a race fan, I don't have to – that's about all I have to say, because that's when Dale got killed. And that was our very first race. We were in the booth, and I'd done some Saturday races. Larry had done some Saturday races. We'd done some other minor races, but we'd never been to the Super Bowl. And the Daytona 500 is the Super Bowl. And so here we are, and it's the best – it was a great race. I mean, there was action. There was wrecks. There was something. I mean, it was easy to do because I'm excited. I'm just off the track. I know what it's like. I know what it feels like. I know what these guys are going through. And Mike was our great leader. He'd been doing TV his whole life. So he would lead us. And Larry and I would just fill in the blanks. And we were having a ball. My brother's driving for Earnhardt, driving the 15 car, Napa car. Dale Jr.'s in the 8 Bud car. Dale's back there in the 3 Goodrich car. And it comes down the end of the day. My brother had never won a race. And it comes down the end of the day of the Daytona 500 after all the wrecks and the dust and smoke had cleared. And it's going to be a shootout between Michael, Dale Jr., and Dale Sr. That's the way the race is going to end up. And sure enough, and I'll never forget, I mean, I was a nervous wreck. I was about to throw up. Michael comes by and there's 5 to go and he's leading. And Dale Jr. is right on his back bumper. And Senior's back there in third block, and everybody keep him getting up to him. Sterling over here, Schrader over here, and Ward Burton. I mean, he was running people all over the track. And I never forgot to poke Larry, and I said, we're at break. I said, Larry, if Dale doesn't quit doing that, somebody's going to wreck him. Because he keeps cutting people off like that. They're going to run over. You're going to get him. Yeah. And then we come back, and more action, more action. White flags in the air. Here's Michael leading the race. I said, well, they're all going to pass him on the last lap. Because he never won a race. 400-some race he hadn't won. They're all going to pass him on the last lap. Lo and behold, they come off turn 2 and go down the back, and Michael's holding his own. Dale Jr. right there. Senior back here blocking everybody. And they get to the third turn. And by the time he gets to the third turn, it's going to take a miracle for Dale Jr. to get by him. I don't even think he's going to try. And they come up turn 4, and Michael's leading, and he's going to win the Daytona 500, biggest race we have. And Dale Sr., I see that black car. I'm watching Michael. I see that black car get loose and go up the track and hit the wall. Well, I'm watching the cars come to the line because, oh, yeah, that's a wreck. And I'm watching the car, and Michael wins. Yeah, I'm so excited about him winning. And then we go to a break, and on the break we go to a replay of what happened. I said, oh, no, this is not good. And Mike and Larry said, what do you mean? It's not good. It'd be all right. It just spun out, hit the wall. You know Dale, he'll be fine. I said, I'm telling you, look serious. They thought I was overreacting. But I could just tell by the way the car turned, went up, hit the wall. We didn't have safer barriers. It was just a concrete wall, head on. When you hit like that, and Schrader hit, I mean, it was kind of the perfect storm. Dale hits the wall this way, and Schrader hits him this way. Bam, bam. Broke his neck, killed him. And that's how we started. That's how we started.
Wow.
Fox Sports covering NASCAR. First race, big race. My brother wins, and Dale gets killed. That was an unbelievable day.
Can't even imagine the range of emotions. It was from pure jubilation with your brother.
1 minute I'm going to Victory Lane to celebrate with my brother, mm-hmm. and the next minute I'm on my way to the hospital. Yeah. To see, first of all, I couldn't believe it. I wanted to go because Dale and I had been, we'd known each other in our careers. We grew up in the sport together. And his grandfather, or his father-in-law, was my best friend. And Brenda, Dale's wife, and I'd seen Kelly and Dale Jr., and I'd seen them grow up as little kids. And here they are racing, and my brother, and, you know, it's just a big conglomeration of emotions going every which way. And I went to the hospital, and it was just an unbelievable experience. There were things that happened in the hospital I don't remember. I don't know why. I can't remember everything that happened that day, but I just remember going there and how devastating it was. Pretty, pretty, pretty big.
Devastating for the sport, you know, to lose a legend. And leads me to a different topic, DW, because when you have a tragedy like that and there's no real answers, I mean, that's when people lean on faith. And you've been strong in your faith. And you shared a story about having the privilege to be the speaker at the National Prayer Breakfast.
Oh, yeah, that was so fun. It was...
That'd be another day you were a little nervous.
Oh, it was unbelievable. I'd given my testimony a lot at different, you know, smaller venues. And I'll never forget my friend David Beasley, who was the governor of Carolina at one time, and his brother Rick and their dad, and all, we all played golf over in Darlington. Southern 500, every year they have a parade and a beauty pageant and a golf tournament. So I'd played golf with Rick and David and their dad, and I loved those guys. They were funny as heck, South Carolina guys. And David called me. He was the head of the committee to find someone to speak at the National Prayer Breakfast. And I'll never forget, he called me, and he said, Beasley, I said, hey, buddy, how's Rick? I'm like, yeah, good. I want to talk to you about something. I said, yeah, what's up, man? He said, I want to talk to you about coming to the prayer breakfast. I said, I've never been. I said, I really wouldn't. I'd kind of like to go. He said, who would I be sitting with? He said, you'll be sitting with the president. I said, really? He said, yeah. I said, that's kind of high up there, bro. He said, well, we want you to be the keynote speaker. I said, now, wait a minute, buddy. Go. I said, you're talking to DW, a race car driver, and you want me to be the keynote speaker at the president's National Prayer Breakfast?
Right.
And I paused, and I said, Beasley, I just don't think I'm qualified for this job. And he said, well, we knew that going in, but you're the guy we want. And I said, I don't know, man. I got to think about this. This might have been in December, maybe. Mm-hmm. So I prayed about it, and Steve and I talked about it, and I said, honey, I mean, you're talking about, there are 4,000 people that go to that prayer breakfast. There are delegates from all over the world, not just Washington. People from all over the world come for that prayer breakfast. You're talking about their president, President Obama and Michelle and senators, and I mean, this is a big deal. We probably said, I'm not going to do it. I just don't feel good about that. So a little bit of time went by. We prayed about it, prayed about it. Steve said, what have you thought? I said, well, Beasley's going to call me back tomorrow, and I got to give him an answer. And she said, when is it? And I said, it's February the 5th. What's your birthday?
Oh, wow.
I said, it is. I hadn't even thought about that. So I thought, okay, that's a sign.
Like 17.
It must be. I'm supposed to do it. If it's on my, it's on a Thursday, it's on my birthday, I'm supposed to do that. So Beasley called back, I said I'd do it. I never worked so hard, so long, anguished so much over giving a speech or a presentation as I did for that one in my life. Day after day after day, I'd write, and I'd give it to Stevie. I would bounce things off of her. What do you think about this? I don't like the way that sounds. I don't, honey, that's what, don't like it. Okay. Right. Think. What about this? Better? Not right. Did that for, probably did that for a month. And finally, just kind of all the pieces, a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and all the pieces started to fall into place. I have a Bible study at my house every Tuesday morning, and been doing that for 33 years. There were like 100 men there last week, and there'll probably be more than that tomorrow because it's our Christmas celebration. Got my speech together, got my thoughts together, and I said, on Tuesday morning, I'm going to present this to the men and see what they think. So I went down Tuesday morning, and I went through my, just
preview?
Like, yeah, I just tried it out. Mm-hmm. And everybody there said, if you have a great speech, great content, if you can deliver it like you did this morning, you'll be fine. Mm-hmm. And the funniest thing about that was I thought I would be nervous. Because I'm literally, Stevie and I are sitting on the dais with President Obama, Michelle, me, Stevie, bunch of senators, and the Dalai Lama.
Oh,
I mean, I don't know how many times they call me and say, How's your speech coming? I am working on it. We need a copy. Yeah, I'm not sure I got it. I'm not right. I'm not there yet. Oh, yeah. When you get a copy, send it to us. No, by the way, you know the Dalai Lama is going to be there, right? I said, I know. Y'all have told me every time you call me. Speechwriters would call me from the White House. Can we help you? We've helped other people. We helped people have been on this, Ben Carson or I don't know who all been on there that's spoken before me. We've helped all of them with their speeches. Can we help you? No, I got this. Well, we need a copy of it. Yeah, I'll get it to you. The day I got to Washington was on Wednesday. We got there on Wednesday before the thing on Thursday morning. The lady that had been talking to me all the time, she said, have you got a copy of your speech? I said, no, ma'am, I'm still working on it. She said, you're not going to give me a copy, are you? I said, no, ma'am, I'm not.
That's your head to the podium.
So anyway, it was an unbelievable experience. I woke up that Thursday morning, and I was as calm as I'd ever been. I was confident. I knew I had what I needed. I just had to deliver it. And that was all God. It wasn't me. The words that came out of my mouth, the way that whole thing went down, the way it came out, I couldn't do it again if I tried. But it was a God. You know, people always say, can you name a time in your life when God showed up? Well, I know that's one time for sure.
What I also heard, DW, is not only was God there, but, you know, for the month before that, as Stevie was there.
Oh, yeah.
Given those revisions as your fellow brothers.
Yeah, well.
That feedback on Tuesday.
Yeah, when you're going to go do something like that, that's in the National Archives.
Oh, yeah.
If you want to watch it, you just go to, that goes all over the world. So it's not like it's a speech you give to a bunch of guys down here at the Bridgestone Arena or that you give at a church or somewhere. It's a big deal. And it was bigger than I even realized. But after it was over with, and they told me all that, you know, the things that they did with it, I thought, whew, glad it turned out well. But, yeah, Stevie's, look, I always give Dr. Cooper, 83, in Hillsborough High School, get on our knees, July, hot, sweating, pray that God will forgive me of my terrible things I've done and be my Lord and Savior and come into my life. And I always give Dr. Cooper credit for that, and he did. He oversaw that whole thing. But my wife, probably from not too long after we were married until today, biggest cheerleader, always never doubted me, always supported me, always encouraged me. Don't give up. May not be like you want it, but we'll make it better. She's been by my side the whole time, and I would probably never have been as successful. I certainly don't think I'd have been as devoted Christian as I am if it hadn't been for her faith and the way she kind of mentored me through all those tough years.
She stood by you.
Oh, yeah. Well, our marriage started off shaky, but today it's as solid as a rock.
Yeah.
And it's good. We'll be married 50 years in September.
That's huge milestone.
Yeah. Or in August, I'm sorry. August 15th.
It's amazing to hear the story about the National Prayer Breakfast and put it in context how big that is.
Yeah, well, the cool thing about that prayer breakfast is that Stevie was there sitting on the stage with me, but both my daughters and their husbands were there too. They were in the audience. Mm-hmm. And so they heard things and saw things that they had never heard or seen before, too. So that was cool.
I bet. And I remember, big deal for me, and why it's just interesting in your perspective, we're invited to appear on Fox and Friends.
Yeah, yeah.
Back on September 12th. I'm like, holy cow, there's 2 million people.
Yeah.
You're like, oh, that'll be easy.
Yeah.
And to put that in context, I think that's part of it, why having to appear on a national stage at the National Prayer Breakfast.
Well, I always think back to that. I told you about Pit Stop, the show we did in Nashville in the early 70s, and Joe Carver and Hope Hines. And it was on TV, local Saturday morning TV show, 30 minutes. And I never forget, we'd go in the studio and they'd say, now, when that red light comes on, we're on the air.
Yeah.
And that they should, I'm fine with that because I know that, but they should never tell people that are not comfortable that on TV that when that red light comes on, we're on the air, because when they see that red light, they go,
they freeze
up. It was so funny when I did those shows early on. We'd have other drivers to come on the show, and they literally wouldn't talk.
Yeah,
I mean, they would sit and listen, or they would yell and no, and you know, car run good or whatever, but they just wouldn't talk. And so I ended up, and the plan was to have somebody different on the show every week. But after about 3 weeks, we said, this ain't working. So we just, the three of us, did it every week.
Got it.
Recap the races.
Well, Diaby, as we're wrapping up, one last question for you. And it relates to our partnership. Ben, so grateful for you to be an investor in Authentically American. And for us, it's a way of life, and it's the spirit of how we operate our company.
Yeah.
So what does it mean to you to be Authentically American?
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's a great name. You know, when you think about Authentically American, you know, every piece of apparel you buy, very seldom you say made in the USA.
Right.
Most of the time, they're made in some other foreign country. Mm-hmm. And so the vision you have for Authentically American and all American-made products, that means we're putting American workers, they're making the product. The charities that you like to invest in, that's huge. You and I kind of halfway crossed paths at one time or another. You were at Procter & Gamble.
Uh-huh.
I was at Procter & Gamble. You worked on Tide. I drove Tide. And so when I met you, great guy, quality guy, West Point, and your vision for this company, it was right in line with things that I believe and things that I'd like to see happen. And, you know, making all these products in the USA is huge. It doesn't happen every day.
We've been so grateful to have your partnership and support. And, you know, as we're wrapping up, I did have a gift for you. And one of
it. You know what? This guy never goes anywhere he doesn't have. You know, he always has a little bag with him. He's got a shirt or something in it. What do you got today?
So, one of them, we didn't get a chance to talk about giving back.
Yeah.
And I know you've been such a believer with the WBC and your hometown heroes, and that could be a whole nother segment. But, you know, with Authentically American, we support the Folded Flag Foundation and Reboot Alliance.
Yeah, we have a race honor of Fogles at Dover, Delaware.
I mean, phenomenal honoring of our American heroes and our first responders. So what we've got is a donation in your name to both of those organizations.
Oh, wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
I love, listen, you know like I know, ministries particularly, they can't run without contributions.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, we have to have the motor racing outreach. Mm-hmm. I'm the chairman of the board, so I get to look at the books every day. And if we didn't have the support from our community, the racing community, we wouldn't exist. Because our ministry is, whether it's in a church that has a steeple, or whether it's at the track in a tent, it takes money to keep that going and keep that ministry on the road. And so I love contribution. People have a heart for that.
Absolutely. So we'll make one to both Folded Flag and Reboot in your honor.
Yes, sir.
But the other one, I don't know if you remember this, I was mad at you because you weren't wearing, like I am, your Authentically American socks. You said, Dean, I only have one pair.
I have two pair. No, I only have one pair.
So we're going to help you out when you're looking for a little more subtle.
Okay. No, so I have this pair. I have these, but I don't have these babies here.
There we go. The red, white, and blue for a great American like yourself, DW.
Look at that.
So.
And I'm a sock guy. I like socks.
Oh, I know.
Yeah, that'll look good. That actually looked pretty good when I got on.
We go.
All right.
Well, DW, thank you.
Oh,
you
fun.
Are a great American with an incredible story.
You need to work on those intros, by the way. You know,
next time, a man
that needs no introduction. That's my
dude. DW, thank you.
All right, pal.
You've been listening to the Authentically American podcast. You can follow Authentically American on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter, and find all our episodes at authenticallyamerican.us/podcast. If you haven't yet, go to Apple Podcasts to subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. Thank you for listening.